listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 164 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin, and joining me is Chris. Chris, how you doing?
I'm very good. I have a new song that's premiering today on a blog of good repute.
Yeah, you've had some interesting things happening there, and we were talking about this earlier this week that you've got mixed feelings about it, but we're going to hold off on the full review of doing blog premieres because you still have a couple more left, and then you were going to kind of do a recap, weren't you?
Yeah, I was waiting for this. This has been, in terms of premiering songs, I think today's, it's on a site called Bluegrass Situation, which is the most high profile blog for one of my song premieres yet for this album. And then on Monday, I won't name the name until it happens, but there's a video premiere for Monday. So I think by next week, I'll have my fully formed opinion.
Yeah, I'm excited about the one for next week. I'm interested to see what happens with that and if it is, you know, kind of a boost and it's, you know, helps grow your audience, or if it's just, well, there it was kind of thing. So,
well, you know, even if three extra people watch it, that's technically a boost.
That's true. So. That's true.
I guess compared against the money and time it might take to, you know, have your publicist line up all this stuff. That's the real consideration.
Well, it looks good in the old press kit.
True.
Later on in the episode, we're going to be talking about is marketing destroying your music career? So that some of the stuff you've been working on and some observations you've had play into that. I have a new embarrassing experience, music experience to share with everyone.
Can't wait.
Happened to me this past Sunday. I play guitar at my church in the worship band, and during the second set of music, it's all quiet, they're about to pray, and right as I step on the stage, there's this giant ripping sound and my pants rip open right through the back.
Wow. So, that has been like, that's one of my worst fears.
And it was so quiet, I thought, there's no way nobody in here, somebody had to notice. And so, you know, it was a serious rip, and I could tell a dramatic temperature change going on back there. So it was hard to tell if I was playing guitar with my backside hanging out, or needless to say, I didn't play very well that last set of music. I was pretty distracted trying to make sure I was covered up.
And you remained facing dead straight ahead. Yeah,
that's
the whole time.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Afterwards, it was a sizable rip. It could have been much worse, I could say, but it was still pretty embarrassing. I was like, just when I start feeling good about myself, something else like this happens.
And just when you start getting feeling good about the jeans that you have on, that's that risk you run of when your jeans are broken into that point of, yep, you know, they're feeling really comfortable, but are they too, yeah, susceptible?
Yeah. I do like the more form-fitting jeans, and I do wear them till they completely fall apart. So that pair of jeans is entered into the first phase of I'm going to keep patching it up until it's just beyond.
Oh, really?
Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They don't just end up under the sink as rags?
No, not yet. This is just the character building part. So, yeah. So that was pretty embarrassing. That just happened to me last week, and it was so loud. It just ripped, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, you got to be kidding me. So
hopefully everyone had their heads bowed in prayer and with their eyes closed, and they couldn't tell where the sound was coming from.
Yeah, I thought I heard someone laughing, but at that point I was just paranoid that everyone in the room was staring at me. So no one said anything to me, but anyway. So a couple reminders before we get into the content portion of the show. To subscribe in iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use, we've been doing a lot of episodes recently, and somebody, I think it was a caller on one of the last discussion episodes we had, mentioned that their iTunes or whatever they used to listen to podcasts had stopped subscribing, and they realized they had 50 episodes waiting to listen. listen to. So don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use. That way you won't miss an episode. We're cranking them out a lot more consistently these days, and lots of good stuff on the horizon. So just wanted to remind you about that. Also, calling our listener line at 360-524-2209 is always an option. And we've got some calls later on in the podcast and some emails. So we love getting feedback and interaction. And, you know, we'll feature you on the show. And maybe you'll get a few new fans because they listen to your music and they heard you on the podcast. But we always like hearing from you. And that's a way you can contribute to the show. Or if you have an idea, if you have an embarrassing moment to share, anything like that, we would love to hear it. That's all the public service announcements for today. So, Chris, there wasn't really any news since our last episode that, I don't know, I looked at it all and I was like, this is boring. We don't want to talk about this stuff. You know, people just bickering about who knows what. No huge developments that I thought would be fun to talk about. So we're going to do something that we used to do back in the day. It's been a while since we'd done this on these discussion episodes, is that we used to kind of recap the previous interview episodes of the podcast. And, you know, we had a couple interview episodes just post, one with Becky Yee, the photographer, and Justin Evans from Lander. And I thought it'd be fun to just a couple observations. We don't need to dive into it too deep, but just a couple observations after those episodes that I think would be fun to chat about. The one thing I was going to say is the thing that both these episodes or those topics have in common is they center around things that artists typically forget to, one, budget for, and two, just do in general or take serious. And that's band photography and mastering. And I talk to so many people that don't budget for band photography, don't budget for mastering, or they get to the end and like, never mind, I don't need that. And so that's one thing those two episodes had in common.
Or if they know that they need it, they have to rush through it, either for budgetary reasons or because their impending releases, you know, is coming up and they need to just get it done. So
yeah, they didn't factor it into the time. That's definitely one thing people forget to do is like, oh, you know, doing a band photo shoot on Thursday will not give me all the photos I need ready to go on Thursday night. Most likely. Depends on the photographer, but you need to plan it ahead and allow for more time in those situations. So did you have any observations about the episodes?
Yeah, well, I really liked the interview with Becky Yee. And I was going to mention that I just recently got back from Folk Alliance International, which is a you know, worldwide folk and singer-songwriter and bluegrass Americana musician conference that happens in Kansas City. And it's, you know, it's not a huge conference, probably about 3,000 people consisting of artists and managers and, you know, talent buyers and labels. But one cool thing about it is that image is very important there. And unlike something like South by Southwest, where flyers and posters are so plentiful that it just becomes like a mess of garbage and you don't even really process it, at Folk Alliance, they have some really interesting ways of highlighting band photography. So, you know, there's good placement of posters, there's digital ads in hallways. The elevator doors have this kind of like, I don't know what you'd call it. Essentially, it's a poster, but it opens in the middle where the elevator door opens. And yeah, so everywhere you look, there's really great band photography. And I was at the CD Baby booth at the exhibit hall one day, and this guy Jim Pellinger came over, who's a CD Baby artist. You know, he's a talented singer songwriter, but he was feeling really overwhelmed and a little, I think, like, yeah, just underprepared in terms of his own visual presentation, and he kind of didn't even know where to start. So I said, "Oh, well, listen to this recent episode of our podcast." And I got an email from him on his way. He lives in Minneapolis, so he drove from Kansas City back to Minneapolis listening to our podcast. And he said that this interview with Becky was super helpful and very timely. So, yeah.
Yeah,
that's my anecdote about that.
I think the one thing that I would the biggest takeaway I'd want everyone to get from it, if you disregard everything else in that interview, but the idea of putting together a shot list and really thinking through that beforehand. And, you know, she stressed a couple times that if you don't get the photos you want, it's your fault, and kind of like blaming the artist for not doing the prep work to communicate with the photographer. And I will say that's probably, you know, 75% of photo shoots that go wrong, that is the case. But I will say that I have done that work with certain situations and still gotten terrible photos. It is a talent thing, and that's part of it. You know, it's not just like anyone can take great photos. There is a talent thing there, and it is hard to find that talented person who's going to get your vision. Just like when you're looking for a graphic designer, you may find a very accomplished graphic designer, and they still can't get the look you're going for.
Right, or a music producer or anything. I think even maybe not more important than talent, but just as important is the relationship that you build between the photographer and the artist, or the music producer and the artist, because they need to make you comfortable. And I've had a few photo shoots where, even though the person is very talented, I start to get a little uptight, because the way that they're managing their shoot is to, you know, really kind of laboriously set up these shots, and then like click, and then, okay, let's spend the next 2 minutes setting up the next shot. I'm like, wait, all this time you're just resting on the hope that maybe my mouth and my eyes were doing something kind of interesting, and we're going to like, it drives me nuts when photographers do that. And like, I guess they're trusting that their composition is right, but I'm picky about how I look, you know, like I want my face to look comfortable and at ease. And like, so that's one of my huge photography pet peeves. Like, I want someone who can set up the shot, think about lighting, get the composition, and then like click, 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 like rapid fire those things, so that by the end of the day, you know, I've got a few hundred things to choose from and not like 15 photos, which, when that happens to me, I'm so baffled, and I always kick myself for not having that discussion that she recommends you have beforehand and say, you know, what's your process? Here's what I expect to get out of it.
Yeah.
The other thing that like drives me nuts sometimes is, you know, I've had photo shoots where they take a bunch of photos and they pretty quickly put them on a site that you can access, and you get to review them all and get high res images. And then I've also worked with photographers who will like start doing all this like color correction and stuff on their favorites, and you haven't even seen anything yet.
Yeah.
And you're like, hey, can you send me your photos? And they're like, oh yeah, I'm just working on them, blah, blah, blah. And then you know, a few weeks later, like, got the photos yet? And then they send you 15 photos out of however many they took that they've color corrected. And you're like, wait, I want to see the rest of them. Like, even if it's only to put me at ease that you actually picked the right ones,
yeah,
I still want to see everything. And then when you send me them at the highest resolution you possibly can. Cause that's another thing. I'm like, you have to like write them back and be like, hey, I need a high res one. And then they say, well, what's high res? What dimensions do you need? Like, what mattered? What the hell? Like, just send it to me. I paid you, and I'll, not crop it, I'll resize it for whatever dimensions I need, like for the rest of my life, because these are supposed to be my pictures now. Like,
yeah, it's funny because the photo world has gone through a major digital transformation, and just like the music world has. I can't remember how much – I haven't mentioned on the podcast recently, but when I first moved to Portland and when I stepped away from Small Town Poets for a time, I actually was pursuing photography and was doing some band photography semi-professionally, and had did a ton of photo shoots for different bands. So it's always my pet peeve working with a photographer that doesn't understand the needs of a band, and that, yeah, I'm going to want everything. I'm a band. I might, the picture that you think is not great might be the perfect album cover, because we're not necessarily looking for us all looking pretty and smiling at the camera. So I had a weird situation where one guy, and this was recently, he took the photos and here's the fee for the session, and you'll get 8 photos, and then I'm going to pick 8 photos for you. I'm like, why do we even care what 8? Why? That doesn't even make any sense.
Right. You already took them, right? I paid you to take them.
But why is he, letting me pick 8, and then he's going to give me 8 that he picks? I'm like, I don't get it. What does your opinion even matter in this
thing? Why don't you let me pick 16?
Yeah, it was so weird. I've run into so many little different twists like that. That's why it's, even when you know what Becky's talking about, like you need to look for these things with a photographer, that it's still, you kind of get thrown these curveballs, and you're like, doesn't everybody know this now that we're shooting for the web? I'm not printing anything. And so anyway, I'd love to hear more artist feedback on that episode or situations they've run into with photo shoots. I don't think I had time to mention it on the podcast with Becky, but there was a photo shoot that was going so horribly wrong for a band shoot here in town, where they were trying to do something where I think they were going to replace the background and make it look like this whole 60s rocket scene or whatever. I don't know. All I know is somehow she had me on my knees perched between the lead singer's legs, and it was beyond awkward, and we were all in these very awkward, and it was just like that whole photo shoot ended up getting scrapped. I'm like, there is no way this looks cool. There's no way this looks. It was so weird.
I was gonna make my guesses about which band and which photographer.
We'll keep that. It wasn't Small Town Poets, but anyway, yeah. So those things are like, it's always an adventure, I will say. So I'd love to hear any more, if anyone has any more stories or advice for artists or ways they've tapped into finding good photographers. There's some good DIY photo tips as well in that podcast that I think near the end we start talking about that are good. That even if you have an iPhone and that's all you got, that if you actually take some time and think about composition, which most people kind of just zoom over, they just kind of get, all right, everyone's in the frame, I can see your faces now, smile, and instead of looking at the band as a shape, as a whole. So I really enjoyed that podcast, hoping that Becky will be back at the conference again next year, and I'm hoping that we can work something out where maybe she does photo shoots or a live photo shoot that we can kind of watch and be more interactive with. So Lander, Chris, I didn't make it up. We did a blind comparison. I was there, you were there. You had tracks. You let me listen to the mix first. Then you didn't tell me what order. You let me listen to the one you'd paid a mastering engineer for and one that you had used through Lander. And no lie, no tricks, I picked the Lander track.
Yeah, so I ended up using, a friend of mine that's a mastering engineer did the album. And then for a couple of those tracks, I put it through Lander. And then I made a folder which had, what would you say? Yeah, blind taste test versions of both of these, of two different versions of two different songs. And I sent them to some friends of mine. And it was evenly split for all of the songs. One of my friends liked, the Lander version. One of my friends liked the mastered the professionally mastered version. And both of them so they were consistent. The one that liked the Lander one liked the Lander versions of all the songs. The one that liked the, professionally mastered one liked that version of all the different songs that they heard. So again, I guess it comes down to taste, but it's a pretty good service if you're even, comparable in that way. Like, I think a lot of doubters would say, oh, well, everyone's going to pick the professional job all the time. But it's not the case.
No, it's not. I could hear a difference. And, before I picked one and you told me which was which, I kind of talked through what I was hearing differently. There was one that had a kind of crispy high end, and there was one that felt like and had a little bit more space in the middle. And I remember saying that I think I like the version A better, but I think version B is Lander because it has this crispy high end that I would expect from an automated thing. And I was wrong. The crispy high end one was the engineer.
I thought mastering always drives me nuts because when you start comparing things, you like different elements of different versions and that's the essence of mastering. You can't ever have it all. In the professionally mastered version, everything had a little bit of that high end crispness and clarity and a little bit more maybe humanity in the that came out in the mixes. And the Lander version had more punch and more, I think it was a little more squashed. So it sounded slightly more, of the digital world, but had a lot of punch and a lot of energy. I was like, man, I wish I could have the punch and energy of one and the clarity and the humanity of the other. But oh well.
Yeah, mastering is the part of making a record that drives me crazy. You know, with mixing, you kind of get what's going on. Then mastering, it just is like, I don't know. Like you said, it feels like you just can't get it all. And there's going to be a trade-off. But I would say with Lander, if you are in a crunch and you're thinking, oh, I'm just going to skip the mastering process, do not do that. It's too cheap and too available to at least use Lander, and it does sound great. I've tried a bunch of different tracks, and it makes a huge difference to the music, and I think there's enough adjustment options with the compression that they give you that you can get something that's better than an unmastered file. And the cool thing is you do it right from your CD Baby dashboard, and it makes it super easy. So don't miss that. It'll make your music sound so much more professional. The other cool thing is, like he said in that interview, songwriters are using it like crazy, and it makes their song demo sound better. And I think that's an excellent reason to be using Lander. Like if you're trading demos in the true sense of the word, like, you know, a lot of people that are professional songwriters, they'll write a song, they'll demo it up with moderate production just to give a sense for, you know, how it could be recorded, and then they'll pitch it to, you know, like country music. This is, you know, how most of country music is done. They'll pitch it to a country artist who they think it fits their style. And so they're using Lander to make their track sound better, and it makes a big difference. So it'll be interesting to see how it develops. You know, it's one of those things where there's a lot of naysayers, and it is weird how easy it is. You drag and drop, and you're like, that's it? I thought I was supposed to, like, languish for 4 days exchanging emails back and forth with an engineer to get this done.
Right. And you A-B it right there pretty much immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
I mean, the other thing, like you already said this, but I have a number of cover songs, and I have a children's song and a couple other things that are, I'm going to release this year as singles. And particularly when you're not even worried about, you know, flow from song to song or consistent levels across a whole album, like this is totally ideal for recording a single and getting it out there really quickly and having it sound really good.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's another great usage for it. And also people that are creating for YouTube that are doing like cover song videos and then want to distribute that. I think it's a perfect usage of that. Live tracks, things that you were going to go, I'm not going to get this mastered, I'm not going to take the time or money. I think at least do this, try it, and it'll make your track sound so much better. And so when someone's in Spotify listening to a bunch of different music and they add your track to a playlist and they're listening to all these professionally mastered tracks and then they get to yours and your volume's way lower and kind of muffly sounding, that's just no good. So that's a good reason why to check it out. So I'd love to hear more feedback. We did have someone weigh in. Ryan weighed in on the comments. He tried it out and he was intrigued. And so I was curious what other artists think about that. I'm really interested in feedback on that because it is such, you know, seems like a polarizing topic these days. So, all right. Well, Chris, we're going to move into our discussion for today. And this comes on the heels of you being at Folk Alliance where you made some observations. And so we came up with the title for the conversation, Is Marketing Destroying Your Music Career? So why don't you set us up for the conversation and explain how on earth marketing could possibly be destroying my music career? Isn't that what I need to be doing?
Oh, yeah. So like I said earlier, I went to Folk Alliance, and it's always really refreshing to go there and to see such a large quantity of really talented players. But one thing that struck me this year after, you know, however many years we've been talking about digital marketing and social media and, you know, a billion different apps that are coming out every week to try and make your life easier and all this sort of tech stuff, is none of it really matters that much when it comes to the artists I've seen become successful over the years at Folk Alliance. So basically what I mean by that is, having gone a number of years in a row, you kind of see, you know, an unknown artist that starts to get a little buzz because they're good. And then the next year they're playing a little bit more high profile showcase. And then the next year they're playing the big showcase. And then the next year they're too, you know, they're too big to even really come back. And those artists are never worried about how often they tweet. They're never worried about their like email marketing strategies. They're never, or you know, that if they worry about it, it's to such a smaller extent than what's of ultimate concern. How good are they? How well are they connecting with their audience? How awesome are their songs? There's a band, Birds of Chicago, who just put out a new record, and they did a big showcase. And, you know, I've seen them in years past, and every year the buzz gets a little bit bigger. And it really comes down to the fact that they are just really, like, enthusiastic and, like, sort of warm-hearted performers, and their music's really good. Their harmonies are beautiful. And when they're walking around and they're meeting people, they're talking to, you know, managers and labels and whatever. It's all about networking, relationships, friendships, getting on the road and playing as many shows as they can and building their fan base like the old-fashioned way. So basically I came back from that saying, in some ways it's relieving to think that the music industry, for all we think it's changed, actually hasn't changed at all. It like comes back to how good are your songs and how are you connecting with your audience, and not connecting with them online, but connecting with them in the real world, where these fans are going to last a long time because, you know, it's so much more powerful than a tweet or an app or whatever.
So, Chris, are you saying I should stop marketing my music?
Well, no. So we should put marketing in quotes, because I think that everything they're doing is marketing. They have a story, they have a sound, they have, you know, talking specifically about Birds of Chicago, but we could name any band that, you know, is at a conference like that that's doing real well. Most of them didn't get there because they decided they were going to sit down and really work on building their Instagram followers. You know, like, they're not photographers. Like, Instagram is an ancillary thing to telling the story of their music and their music, you know, the sort of life around being a musician. Like, so the basically, I think we get so sidetracked and just misdirected when we think, man, how am I going to increase my YouTube subscribers? How am I going to build my Instagram following? When that's not what you want to do. Like, ultimately you want to be an artist. You don't want to be a photographer. I don't know if I'm encapsulating this notion enough, but basically I think what these bands are doing is a form of marketing. They're getting the story out there one audience at a time, the old-fashioned way, and it's working. And it's working because the marketing is authentic to who they are, and it's centered around this thing that they're really passionate about, you know, unlike whatever the new app is or any of these social media trends that come and go.
Yeah, when you were telling me this after you got back from Folk Alliance, a couple things popped into my head at first. One is that I think we went through this time period where so much music that never had access to the market before now had access. And by that, I mean, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was hard to track down certain styles of music if they weren't in the top 40 or the top 100, you know, the pop rock category. It was really hard to find certain types of music. And then as places like CD Baby grew and opened up the market for a lot of music, there was this period of like just massive discovery, like, oh my gosh, there's this kind of music out there and I'm going to go check it out. And there's this kind of music. And I think we've gotten past that where everybody knows there's all sorts of music out there. And sure, there's still tons of discovery going on. But I think we went through this period where people were seeing success just because markets were opening up. But now, and so that kind of gave this idea of like drive awareness. And I think started to pull people back a little bit from just focusing on continuing to make great music. So that was one thing that came to mind. I might be wrong with that one. That was just something that I thought of, that, you know, where there was this period where the idea that I could go listen to all these very niche artists for hours on end was just like, I wouldn't say a novelty, but just so cool that, oh man, I can go and find all these guitar players that would never be able to, you know, have a big enough audience that someone would go to the trouble of signing them to a deal and putting them on all these, you know, putting them in stores with physical CDs, and it just wouldn't make sense for them. But now that music can exist. And that's one of the amazing things I think we do at CD Baby. But the other thing that came to mind was that I gave a presentation recently about marketing music, and I've been in many presentations where someone's talking about marketing music, and the first thing they start out with is by saying, what's your Facebook strategy? What's your Twitter strategy? And they go on and on about
snore
those platforms. And so when I was giving my presentation, I was like, I said, marketing your music is not about sitting on Facebook all day. It's not about spamming your followers on Twitter or spamming them by email. And I followed up with, those are amazing platforms to communicate with people, but that's all they are. You know, we, you and I at CD Baby, we work in marketing, and usually all our conversations around, you know, campaigns and what we need to say are wrapped up in what's the story we need to tell? What's the message we need to get across? Then we go and figure out how to put a strategy on Twitter or Facebook. And I think so many artists are frustrated with where they're at in their career because they feel like they've been told they have to be Twitter experts or Facebook experts, and they spend all their time on those platforms and totally neglect the idea of being an artist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, tailoring the message to the medium is great, but I think what happened after that sort of, you know, flood of new content into the world that you were talking about that happened, whatever, 10 or 15 years ago, is this huge trend of like, that people thought in order to stay ahead of the noise or cut through the noise, you just had to make more noise, which it doesn't help anything. So people were really concerned with volume. You know, I have to be tweeting so many times a day, and I have to make sure I've scheduled out all these pictures that are going to go live, and what, you know, who knows what they're doing, but like they're spending all their time doing anything but making new music or getting better at their instrument or finding out how to become, you know, a more confident, engaging performer, or, you know, any number of things that we have enough to do in order to be good artists. So adding this other stuff is such a distraction, or can be, I think, for a certain kind of person. So that was basically the cautionary tale I was thinking, is like, just don't give up the thing that brings you the most joy and that fills you with the most sense of purpose. Because when you think about marketing, that again is the story. That's the thing that's going to come through and seem authentic and make you fans.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, why developing your art, your story as an artist should be a focal point is because if you don't do that, you have nothing to say on those platforms. It's like, here I am again, go buy that album I did 3 years ago. I'm going to keep telling you that. I'm going to say the same thing tomorrow because I've spent all my time trying to master these platforms. And I think a couple other things have happened. One, you get people that then they get so obsessed with it that it's become like a benchmark of success that they start gaming the system. And it's like, you're not building a career. You might have gained 1,000 followers by suspicious means, but that doesn't build a career. And it may feel good to see that number go up, but what you want is for people to hear and love your music so much that they want to hear more, and not necessarily that they want to see more of your Instagram feed. Now,
yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was thinking of some of these artists that I'm referring to that were at Folk Alliance that I've seen over the past 3 or 4 years kind of grow their career and seemingly doing it through focusing on the music and their connection with their fans. They do eventually get to a point where they need help. They need help with booking. They need help with publicity, obviously. And they also at some point need help with the tech side of things and social media. And so it's like, not to say that they're not doing it or that it's not important for, you know, at some point to kind of hand off to someone who can do it full time and all that. But I just haven't seen it being like a key element in their success. It sort of becomes a necessary way of maintaining their success, I think. But they did it, you know, a step at a time, one fan at a time. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to characterize it that, like, stop using all these platforms, don't email your fans, because I think that would be counterintuitive. I would say these platforms should be used as a means to take a story to an audience. If you don't have the story, then stop messing with a platform that's intended to tell a story when you don't have the story. You know, because I think Instagram, I've seen some really cool things with artists connecting. I've actually discovered several bands recently through Instagram, and it's, you know, it's a trade-off. It's like, how much time am I going to spend, you know, shooting these cool little Instagram videos And you kind of have to figure out where the balance, where the line is for you. But I think the point is that it's become so commonplace for people to walk around with their head in their phone and miss regular real world opportunity because they're so busy trying to post something else to people elsewhere instead of being present with the opportunity that's right in front of them. So I think, yeah. I think that's something to consider.
And I think another thing to be careful of on that topic is people really now want to be like early adopters of all this stuff, like whether it's a new social media platform or a new app that's going to help you, who knows, you know, manage your inventory in Sri Lanka or whatever. Like, do you even have that problem? Like, aren't you just playing in Minneapolis and maybe you're driving as far as Chicago? Like, what the hell do you need that app for? Are you really moving that much merch? Or like, there's just so much stuff that like artists are you know, they're what's the word? They think that all this stuff is going to be some magical solution, but all it does is create another account, some other thing they need to manage. And basically, like, my mentality is, you know, let other people vet that stuff and, you know, just keep recording and playing. And then if 2 years later, you know, folks are still using Snapchat like they are, then maybe you think, oh, okay, Snapchat's still around. What can I do with it? Are my fans even there? Do I want to do it? Okay, fine, or no. But like, don't be so eager to download every single app that you find, and because there's learning curves to all of it. And then again, that's just more time you don't have. So I would say wait until you actually have a problem and you find something that, you know, comes across your desk that you think, oh, that actually solves a problem I have in my daily life in music. And then download it and figure it out. But otherwise, leave that shit to other people.
I think one thing that's interesting is, you know, artists, especially if you're not playing live, I think you can kind of feel like you're on an island. Maybe you communicate with people online, like other artists, or have some community that you're a part of. But it is definitely thrown in our face constantly by technology companies. This will make things easier. This will make things better. This will make you better. And I think it's real easy to think that, oh, every artist is using this to achieve success. And I talk to a lot of app companies and people that are little startups that are trying to, you know, create stuff for musicians. And so many times my feedback for them is, you've clearly never been a musician, because one, artists don't want to do this. Two, they don't have time. And three, I don't think you realize what the, you know, what life is like for the average independent artist. They're not juggling, like you were saying, thousands of pieces of inventory as they go to show, you know, they've got a box of stuff in their van and they're selling it and they're fine. They don't need.
And if they are juggling that much inventory, someone else is juggling it for them.
Yes.
You don't need to market it to the indie musician. It's like, you know, they've got a tour manager that's handling all of it.
Yeah, exactly. And there was somebody that actually came to us and we met with multiple times that had a really cool app. And we kind of said, you know what, we're not, the independent artist is not your target audience. Your target audience is managers of people that are doing like sizable tours, because it was all this management software. I'm like, who's managing that? You know, if you get to that point where you have that many details, chances are you have help. And that's getting there. But
one thing you said in another separate discussion, but that's related to this, is another issue that a lot of apps and new social services have, or not social services, social media platforms, you know, when they're first launched, they don't really have any users. So is it worth the artist's time to start using it as a way of connecting with people who actually aren't even there? Like, so then instead of, again, either making music or continuing to use the tools they already have, say they're already on Twitter or Facebook. Instead of that, now they have to spend even more time convincing their fans to move to such and such new tool or platform so they can do something new and cool that has nothing to do with the music again. And it's just like, wait, just let some time pass. See if, you know, 2 years down the line, there's a few million people using this thing, and then jump on board.
That's why I'm still a MySpace user.
I was actually driving down the street the other day wondering if my MySpace account is even there anymore. Like, is it?
I think they are. I heard actually some piece of news about them recently. Like, someone was potentially going to acquire them again and turn it into something else. I don't know. It's actually, if you haven't been there in a while, the last time I was there, back when Justin Timberlake was trying to revive it, it was actually a pretty cool looking site. It's just that they destroyed everybody's accounts and made artists lost all their fans. So it's like, no one wants to build a new following on an antiquated platform. So
in MySpace's defense, though, I would not lump whatever MySpace was in 2005 to 7 or 8 or whenever it started to decline in that way. I wouldn't lump them in with like this kind of category that we're talking about. I feel like MySpace, when it came out, was so useful for so many musicians. I feel like it did solve a problem.
Absolutely.
And then they totally, you know, blew it or it was overtaken by Facebook at that point. But I wouldn't lump that just because it's lost popularity and no one uses it anymore. I still think for its moment, it was an incredibly useful tool. So yeah, not to dump on them as just another waste of time.
No, it's always good for a good joke whenever you throw MySpace out there. But no, you're absolutely right. It did solve a problem. And at that time, club bookers were expecting that you had a MySpace page. In fact, years later, I think this was like 2012 or something, I played a gig with somebody at a club here in town and they put a link to the MySpace page. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? It's 2012. No one's using MySpace links anymore, but that club booker sure was. And it was a very reputable club here in town. I was like,
and then you're like, oh no, they're using our songs from like 8 years ago. And
yeah, so then I had to go try and figure out how to update that. And I was like, could you just change that out, please? I think to kind of bring this home some, where I would sum things up is that the shift of conversation I've been having with artists about how do I market my music? How do I reach a broader audience? It starts with you as an artist. And if that doesn't excite you, then maybe you should just go get a marketing job if you want to spend all your time on Facebook. But it starts with you as an artist, and it starts with your music, and it starts with you being great at what you do, the uniqueness of who you are, and that the way you're going to grow fans is by making more music, building a catalog, and that catalog will provide so many storylines that then you take those and you put on the platforms of your choice, and not the other way around. Obsessing over Twitter followers, Instagram likes, Facebook, now they've got all sorts of things. So it's not just thumbs up or likes. You can be angry.
You can be angry. And wowed. And,
yeah. Obsessing over those things don't build your career, but obsessing over driving yourself as an artist do. And the one thing I always say to artists is that, especially, you know, when I've given a presentation, like I often do at conferences and talk about my whole story of where I've been as an artist, is I always say that if you want a music career, it's a long game. There's lots of things where you can see like someone, it's seeming like they're having overnight success and everything's great in their life. But music is a career is a long game, and there's lots of peaks and valleys. Even when people are at the top, they go away for sometimes 3-4 years and they're struggling through a new album. You know, they're not out on the road making tons of money, and then they emerge and kind of have new life in their career. And there's lots of peaks and valleys in a music career.
They emerge and the mics fall into the piano at the Grammys.
Yes. Oh, poor Adele. Anyway, I think that's one of those things you kind of have to look at, that it's not always going to be that every day is going to be this social media bonanza for you, or everyone's going to be talking about you, but just keeping your head down, focusing on making more art, because that's what's going to drive your career.
Yeah, there's like an element of maybe assessing what feels natural to you. Like, so thinking about my own life, like if there's a few months that go by and I haven't really been making much music, I might wake up one morning and be stressed about, oh no, I haven't shared anything on Facebook. What am I going to write on Facebook? Well, I don't have anything to write on Facebook. I haven't been doing much with music. Like, so I'll like dream up something to write, or maybe I'll find an old picture and I'll share it. And, you know, people are like, who cares? Like, whatever. It gets minimal response, as opposed to if I'm going into a studio and I'm going to record a new song and I get a little video and I share that, or, you know, I'm on the road and I take a picture of some taco stand that I'm driving by. Like, that is something I'm doing in my actual life. So I'm excited about it. So when I share it, it feels real and it feels exciting, or, you know, at least it's exciting for me. So it feels natural. So I'm more likely to do it. And then that's the kind of thing that I feel like gets results, as opposed to the like, oh no, it's Monday and I need something to tweet about.
Yeah. Well, I think it comes down to being intentional with those platforms and having a purpose, as opposed to just wasting time. And if you feel like you're just wasting time, then stop, because you could make better use of the time making music. And to me, that's what it comes down to. So when we talk about like, is marketing killing your music career? What we're really saying is, are these things really becoming a burden that's distracting you from what you really should spend time on? Since the new year, I've been really focusing hard on spending lots of time writing and recording new music. At Christmas, I had 2 weeks off, and I spent so much time playing and so much time just getting better as a musician. And I've been trying to make that a discipline. So I've been getting angry at myself when I find myself just mindlessly like looking at Facebook. I'm like, what am I doing? There's nothing, no value here. I could be working on music that does have value. And that's what we're really talking about. Are you being intentional and purposeful with telling your story and getting your music out there? Or are you just wasting time?
Don't waste time.
Don't waste time. You only have so much, especially when you have kids. Then you have very little.
This could have been a very short podcast. We just say, don't waste time.
Don't waste time. We wasted a whole lot of time telling people just to not waste time. All right. Well, we'd love to hear your feedback, your comments. If you have anything you'd like to say about things you do to simplify and keep the focus on music, telling your story. And, you know, we always love tips and tricks about getting your music out there and connecting with people. So if you have something to share, listener line is 360-524-2209. And you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or leave a comment at the website in the show notes. All right, Chris, we do have some feedback and some emails. And I gave you the choice last time. What do you want to start with? Phone calls or emails?
Let's do a phone call.
All right. This is Ron from Baltimore.
Hi, this is Ron from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm part of a singing songwriting duo, and we were interested in finding out what's the best avenue to get our songs heard by industry people, not for a record deal, but for film and TV licensing and other publishing deals, or maybe other artists that may be interested in taking our song. We noticed that there's a ton of online avenues such as Reverb Nation, TuneCore, Music X-Ray. And my first question is this the way it's done nowadays? Do we go through these channels to get our songs heard by industry people, or is this kind of like more of a facade? I mean, are these companies really legit in trying to help the artist find a new way to get our songs heard? Or is there a website you could suggest that maybe we could go to find out all the details about these companies and find out who's legit and who's not? And if maybe possibly in the near future you could have a podcast maybe centered around that for songwriters and people that just want their music to be published, not for bands going on tour and stuff like that. That would be a fantastic podcast to me. That would help us directly. So thank you again for listening to our question. The name of the duo group that we call ourselves is Breaking 12. We're at breaking12.com. Thanks a lot, guys, and keep up the great work.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ron. Chris, did you have any immediate
feedback? Well, no, I was eagerly awaiting your response.
Okay.
I think it was a really good question.
My response would be that, yeah, there's a lot of companies online like Reverb Nation, Music X-Ray, Taxi Music is another one that have opportunities, and a lot of them are around the song more often. Sometimes they're sync licensing. Sometimes they're people looking for tracks to go on a record. I've heard mixed results from some of those. I've heard some people have some great success with Taxi, and I've heard some people really love Music X-Ray. And I don't know that I've ever talked to anybody that's used the Reverb Nation service. And I think there's even a couple other sites out there. What I would say is those tend to be more passive type methods of doing that. where, you know, you have limited ability to go be proactive, and it's kind of, you have to wait until something kind of comes down the pike that fits what you do. And, you know, sometimes they can get you some leads, but they're typically more passive. If I was a songwriter and just an aspiring songwriter, I would make sure, one, that I was a member of a performing rights organization like ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC here in the U.S., mainly because a lot of those organizations are geared more towards, because they represent songwriters and publishers, they're geared more towards around the song. And they have information, sometimes classes, sometimes meet and greets, and ways that you can meet other people in those communities. And if I had tracks that were ready to go that were, I was looking for sync placements, I would make sure I was in some of those passive catalogs, but I would also make sure that I was working with a sync licensing company that was actually had a smaller catalog and pitching more of my music. At CD Baby, we have a sync licensing program that it's like one of those more passive things. There's opportunities that come up, and there's the micro sync portion of what we do. But I think it's also important to work with a licensing company that's actually going to pitch your tracks. And then on the lastly, I'd say is if you're trying to get cuts on records, that's where you just need to go pound the pavement and meet publishers and have a good selection of songs and know what publishers are working with, what artists. You know, when I lived in Nashville, it would be like, you know, there's all these publishing companies that all they would do is all day long is pitch songs to be on whatever country record was being recorded at that time. So they would typically have some good relationships with artist managers or whatever. And so they'd be getting their songs in front of those artists. So you really kind of have to have that kind of relationship, have a publisher working for you. So that's my answer.
Yeah. The only thing I would add is check the exclusivity of certain sync deals, because with CD Baby, you're welcome to sign up and have us, you know, try and get your song placed in places and also work with other agencies as well, as long as that's cool with the other agency you're working with. So it's okay to have multiple people trying to place your songs.
Yeah, typically a more boutique type company that has a smaller catalog it's going to be an exclusive deal. But typically that means that there's the chance and likelihood of you getting a placement goes way up, because they only accept things into their catalog that they think they can actually place. So that's the brief answer without knowing more about what you're trying to do with music. But thanks for the call. Hope that helps. All right. Since we started with calls, Chris, we've got one more call. This is Matt.
Hey, Kevin. This is Matt Warren. Love your show. I am just so confused. I'm trying to figure out if I can do a cover song on YouTube or not. And I know that some publishers are partnered with YouTube for monetization, and I just don't know the answer. I don't know the process, or I can't seem to get a good answer. So I thought I'd reach out to you guys. Maybe you guys could fill me in. All right, bye.
Thanks for the call, Matt. So cover songs on YouTube, it gets into some gray area. Most people, rights holders, that being the major labels, are fine with cover songs. They sort of just look the other way, but not really. And that's what the whole content ID system at YouTube was made for, was to monetize content that people were doing on YouTube and allow the people that own the rights to that music to make money while not killing the user-generated aspect of YouTube that makes it so great.
I wonder, should we back up a second and just talk about the difference between like mechanical licenses and sync? Because YouTube, you know, technically requires a sync license if you're going to be doing a cover song video. Unlike just putting a cover song up on iTunes, where as long as you're paying the royalty to the publisher, then you are, you know, that is a compulsory thing that you're granted.
Yeah, and technically, they're not going to say anything if you don't get that. But yes, Chris is right. And this is where it gets murky, because that is what you're making a video, you're recording a song, you're putting that song in the video, there is a sync placement that just happened. And so you owe that kind of consideration. But the idea of going to those labels and ever getting their permission to do a sync for your video, it's just never going to happen. So that's why you see everyone flooding YouTube with cover songs. There is a way to ensure you're doing it 100% legally. And we've actually just partnered with a company to do a cover song contest, a YouTube cover song contest. So you should check it out at illustratedhits.com. It's running through March, but there's this website called We Are the Hits. And when you upload cover songs, if it's an approved cover song in that catalog, which they have like 85% of the, you know, major label content approved, you upload it into their system and then you know your video is completely free and clear and done properly. But, you know, like I was saying, it becomes a big gray area. The things I would say is that one, never, never, never record or do anything with a karaoke track or a sample from the master recording. That they will flag and take down. The labels are pretty adamant about that. So if you're doing your own creative version of a cover song and posting it on your channel, you're most likely going to be fine. And you will get a notice on your YouTube video that it has been tagged and that, you know, that somebody owns that song. And you'll start seeing ads run on your video. And that's because that's them monetizing it on behalf of those owners.
Rights owners.
Yeah. So that's, it gets real complicated. This question reminded me that we said we'd do a YouTube focused podcast a while back, and we need to make that happen. And we can outline that out, but I know it sounds like a kind of a convoluted answer, but I don't know if you were on the thread, Chris, that I had with our director of publishing, where we were asking this question and going back and forth. And there really was still some gray area with how YouTube works that hasn't truly been ironed out yet, where there's the letter of the law, then there's how YouTube works. So stay away from samples, karaoke tracks,
And Prince songs,
and any piece of the master recording whatsoever, and you should be fine. If anyone has a question, typically they're willing to work with artists because they want their music catalog to keep generating revenue. But just stay away from using people's master recordings, and you should be fine. So I hope that helps. We'll try and provide more clarification and do a YouTube-focused episode soon. All right, we got a couple emails to get to. This is from Mark. Carrie, I've gotten really into the podcast and been binge listening. I'm a singer-songwriter from Utah, currently living in Los Angeles. I love the show, but one thing I've noticed is that most of the episodes talk about issues with the assumption that you already have an established fan base. I would love to hear an episode talking about getting fans that are outside your friends and family, how to convert your fan base from friends and family to people that like you because of your music. Hope that makes sense. You can check out my music under artist name Mark Carey and albums titled The Ocean's Edge and The Ocean's Edge Volume 2, found everywhere thanks to CD Baby.
That's a really good question. We should do an episode like that.
Like where you go from the absolute starting point, I guess.
Yeah, that would be a great episode. I mean, the tricky thing is it probably differs depending on your genre. Like I would tell him if he's a singer-songwriter to start going to real low-impact open mic things where he can make friends and maybe, you know, get people on his email list without, you know, booking a show that no one's going to show up to and then burning a bridge with that talent buyer. But it's going to be different for a rock band or a hip hop crew or something, you know, like it's not like an open mic setting is available to all genres. But yeah, it's
I think
something to think about.
I think the first thing I would say is be an active member in the music community there, wherever you live, whatever that looks like. If there's some meetup groups, if there's, you know, just going to shows by other artists in your town that are, you know, a little bit more established, but still accessible, making friends with them, getting some advice, and especially people that are in your same genre group, and then looking for opportunities to like, hey, can I just open and play a couple songs for you guys and be prepared to capitalize on those fans, you know, getting names, shaking hands, getting email addresses. And that's a good way to start. But I think being an active member in the community is always a good place.
And I think part of that could be, is, you know, as long as you're not pushy about it, you could go and check out a band and you like their show, and then write them an email and say, hey, you know, I'm new to this scene. I would love to pick your brain for a half hour. Can I, like, you know, get you a drink or coffee or something? And yeah, start that conversation. But, you know, at when it's convenient for them, and you know, but if you can get those opportunities to open for people who have existing fan bases, that's a direct way for to you to get in front of new audiences.
Yeah, I think that's a solid answer. Like you said, it might vary depending on what kind of music he does.
If you play bagpipes, you could just pretty much go into any public place and just start playing. And most people will run, but the ones that stay, they're your fans for life.
They are, because when you find someone who likes bagpipes, they are diehard. All right, we've got one more email. I just listened to the podcast about licensing cover songs. Annie Lynn's little anecdote about asking for a place to crash and getting it at the former CEO's office told me everything I need to know about your company. I'm an aspiring songwriter, and I can tell you, after hearing that, I will certainly choose CD Baby should I ever require any of the services you offer. I promise not to ask for a place to crash, though. Thanks for the podcast. Regards, Ron. Thanks, Ron. And you probably still could get someone to let you crash on their couch if you were in town.
There's even more people that work at CD Baby now, so odds are even greater.
I just passed my 10th anniversary at CD Baby, and I was remembering what it was like when I started. And, you know, when I started, it wouldn't be out of the norm to walk into work and people be sleeping all over the place, and I wouldn't know if they were employees, homeless people, or musicians passing through. It's toss-up.
Or all three.
All three, a mix.
That we had the beanbag. That questionable couch.
Very questionable couch. That couch, that's funny. I remember seeing Derek have a meeting with, like, these business guys in suits, and the business guys were sitting on that couch, and it was the couch that someone had brought their dog to work multiple times, and the dog kept peeing on that couch.
You never quite know which side of the cushion should be.
Yeah.
Just the one that's slightly less damp, that's the good side.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
While we're reminiscing, I should say my favorite old CD Baby, well, not my favorite, but my favorite that can be told on a podcast is every morning I'd go, you know, at some point to the bathroom, and on top of the urinal every day would be a different colored gummy bear.
That's true story. That
for no apparent reason. For, it's just someone's weird candy performance art.
Yeah. And no one would ever know who was doing it or ever see anyone putting it there. It would just happen. It was very odd. I just hope no one was eating them and putting a new one out. Yes. We have grown up since then. We have grown up since then, hopefully, some of us. Well, I appreciate the calls, the feedback. We love getting responses from folks in the artist community. Again, the number is 360-524-2209. If you can keep your call is, you know, on the brief side, it makes it easier to put on the show. And you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And yeah, tell us, you know, how your career is going in 2016, how you're managing the temptation to spend all your time futzing with the latest craze of apps as opposed to writing and recording and moving your career forward. Whatever you want to talk about, we're here for you. So, all right, well, that's gonna do it for this episode of the podcast. And I guess we'll catch you next time.
See ya.
Been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.